Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, Leila Lateef.
Hello.
Hello. So this week, before we bob off to Venice, we are rating horror comedy The Blackening, Sundance Amusement Theatre Camp, British Rib Tickler Scrapper, and Lucasfilm latest Ahsoka. But before we get onto that, Leila, what have you been watching this week? And what are you anticipating getting your teeth into next week? Because we will be on the Lido in Venice, won't we?
I can't believe it's only a week away. But yeah, now I'm having a back-to-back really good time because I just got back from Edinburgh. And like, I think probably two of the greatest things in the world are Edinburgh in August and September in Venice. So very spoiled at the moment. Yeah, that was really a really good festival. And it's quite interesting because, you know, they had a big, you know, they almost went under last year and then they were kind of rescued by the kind of larger festival. But it's come back much smaller in the best way. Like, I think they used to do between like 150 to 100 films. And like this year it was like, you know, maybe in like the mid to high 20s, but it meant like everything got a lot of attention and it just like felt there were no fillers. Everything was really, really interesting. Like stuff from like, you know, some things I kind of heard of like Past Lives or Showing Up, the new Kelly Wright art. But yeah, I got to see some amazing Scottish films, one called Silent Roar, which was a very strange kind of teen thriller sex comedy, I suppose you call it. The Irvine Welsh documentary was absolutely fabulous. And yeah, there's a podcaster I love called Aubrey Gordon, who she had a documentary about her called Your Fat Friend. That was just like really moving. And I just credit her so much with like personally with her podcast and like with this documentary. It really like makes you completely rethink bodies in the world and like also, you know, your own body. So yeah, some really, really exciting stuff. But yeah. And then Venice next week, we're spoiled.
Yeah, what are you looking forward to next week? We've got all sorts. We've got Ferrari, we've got The Killer from David Fincher, we've got Priscilla from Sofia Coppola. I mean, what's on your list for must-sees?
Oh, I mean, definitely all of those ones, but Lanthimos's Poor Things, very, very high up there for me. But yeah, I mean, Fincher doesn't miss. There isn't a bad Fincher film, so that's going to be like very exciting. I think I'm least looking forward to the Michelle Franco, who's like one of the most sadistic filmmakers probably ever around. But yeah, I also feel like Venice is a good place for like discovery, things that like you weren't anticipating turn out to be a favourite of the year. Like last year with me going to see Saint-Omer, not thinking that it was, you know, just some tiny little French film and, you know, kind of changed my life.
Well, yes, exactly. Let's hope there's life-changing things ahead then in Venice. My personal number one is the Priscilla film, obviously. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to see that and see what Jacob Elordi does with Elvis. Obviously, he's not in it as much as Austin Butler was in the Baz Luhrmann, but I'm interested to see what it's like to follow a performance that's been so lauded by everybody and that everyone said that's the definitive Elvis performance. And then this guy has to come along and do it again. So I'm really intrigued to see that.
I believe they've just gotten permission from the WGA and SAG that they're actually going to be able to promote that as well. So we get, you know, obviously things are still striking, but like we get a few stars. We get the Penelope Cruz and Adam Driver for Ferrari, and we'll get the Priscilla crew. So, you know, bit of glam in between.
Yeah, and we'll get, let's not forget, an Aperol spritz and the pizza and some good spaghetti.
Mamma mia!
So basically why we go.
That's the only reason, isn't it? Let's face it. Okay, so let's not think more ahead. Let's think about current events. It's time to play games now with this.
No, no thank you.
The Blackening?
Oh. Whoa!
Jim Crow Monopoly.
That shit probably runs on racism.
Pick a card and save Morgan.
What do you mean, save Morgan?
Refuse to play, and she dies.
I think we have to play the game.
In your predicament, the black character is always the first to die. I will spare your lives if you sacrifice the person you deem the blackest.
The blackest?
You have 2 minutes to decide.
Wait.
Y'all can't pick me. I'm gay.
Oh, Clifton.
Yeah.
That can prove I'm not the blackest.
Prove it.
I've never seen Friday. I voted for Trump.
What?
Twice.
So this is The Blackening. Leila, what's The Blackening?
So The Blackening is a film that was like, it was originally a short that was created by like an improv comedy group in Chicago. And then Tim Story, who's kind of best known as like the big blockbuster director for like the Fantastic Four films and the Ride Along films, came on board and he kind of made it into, expanded it into a feature. And a lot of the cast changed, but the central concept is basically your classic cabin in the woods. But everybody who is being reunited there, this kind of, in some ways, like the classic horror archetypes, they are all black. And in kind of those typical things, the joke is that the black person dies first. But in this case, the killer who is, you know, hunting them down one by one is, you know, in a bit of a pickle because they're all black. So it's down to them to kind of decide who is the blackest and therefore figure out the order of their demise, which sounds dark. And at times it is, but it's so funny. Tim Story is not the person that I would necessarily look to for like incredibly intelligent humor in a like indie comedy, but I think this is his best film, and I think there's a few star making turns in it, particularly like X Mayo as the sort of excessive party girl, and Jermaine Fowler, who's kind of, his character is kind of,
he's like an Urkel character, isn't he? I expected him to say, did I do that?
Yeah, and it should be annoying, but somehow he kind of keeps it just on the right, on the right side of things. But also Dwayne Perkins, who I kind of just knew as being a delightful person on Twitter. Like, they keep trying to like sideline him into being like the gay best friend role. And it's like really clever and intelligent the way that he, as a queer person, like refuses to do that. So yeah, I've seen it twice, and I think on the second time I appreciated it even more, like that it's really brilliantly written and it's really well performed, even though it's very, very silly.
It's one of those ones where it sort of fell a little bit between two stools for me if I was being super critical. So I'm going to be super critical first before I get into what I liked about it, but that it wasn't quite funny enough or scary enough. It wasn't either or. And so it sort of fell between those two things a little bit for me. And also I guessed who it was fairly early on. But I guess that doesn't really matter, because the point of it is that you also do that when you watch Scream or any of those sort of films. You have a pretty good idea. So yeah, it's more about the participation of this. I went to see it with a big sort of rowdy group of people. We'd all had like Kool-Aid cocktails before we went in, strawberry Kool-Aid, which were extremely sweet, which when you see the film, you'll understand why we got those. And it's very much a film that encourages you to interact with it as well. So it was just like really good fun to be in that room. And so I didn't get all the jokes, I have to say. I didn't get, there's a bit where somebody quotes Sister Act 2, which I wasn't aware of what that was, and I had to Google it afterwards, and I'm not au fait with the Riley's auto parts ad, so I didn't really know what that was. So there were bits of it that I didn't get. Now I've sort of Googled them, I want to go and watch it again knowing those things and being sort of complicit in it. But it definitely does invite you to sort of shout at the screen and say, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? And as you say, for me, the star of it is Dwayne Perkins. He's just brilliant in this. Everybody's great in this, and that's another thing that's good about it. Everyone gets their moment to shine and gets a really good sort of kick-ass moment, but he sort of does steal it out from under people most of the time in his robe that says "that bitch" on the back. He's brilliant. So yeah, I love that, and I love little sort of details like somebody's trying to shoot a bad guy with the gun on the side, and another person comes and turns it the right way up. And it's sort of the amount of sort of little moments that are in this. You can watch this many times and see different things every time, I think.
Yeah, because I mean, there's the big silly jokes with like vomit and you know, it's stuff that is not subtle at all. They like almost, it's almost feels a bit scary movie in the first bit, because they do that kind of parody of like, oh, the big stars that arrive first, and you have the little short at the beginning. It doesn't really, I think, take off until like the main ensemble actually arrive, and you sort of see the dynamics between the groups, because I think so often with these things, you don't really feel like these people know each other, but these guys have got really good chemistry as a group. And I believe Dwayne Perkins is the only person from the short that came over, and he did write it. I mean, that was a really wise choice, because he's just the star. I mean, like, that feels like such a kind of old Hollywood mogul thing to say, but like, this kid has it.
Yes, he really does. And
even his costume changes were so funny to me.
Yes.
Like, just his like subtle little how he just, you know, even and in a crisis.
Like, did you change your clothes? It's like, yeah. Yeah, no, that was very good. But let's talk about it as well. It is not only funny, it has something to say as well. I mean, as much to say as Get Out had to say, I would argue. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I think, I mean, it's kind of tonally a lot kind of more comedy than Get Out was, but it's like just as insightful at points. Like, I mean, there's these kind of like tiny little tragic moments where at one point somebody says, like, can you think of any white people that would want to kill us? And they were like, potentially all of them.
Yeah.
You know, like little things like those little tragedies. And I won't give away the way that it ends, but there's a kind of moment involving like, okay, once the big finale is happening, where people would kind of do the typical kind of epilogue thing. But as a group of black people, that's not really available to them. And that moment where that sinks in for them, I thought was just such a smart little pause to take.
It's got a great soundtrack as well. Yeah, I think it's a good time out of the movies with any kind of group of friends to really enjoy it. And I don't know who wouldn't sort of get a kick out of some of this, really, because there is jokes for everyone. I mean, there's splitting up jokes. There's jokes about a savior that turns up and can you trust them? There's sort of, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre kind of tropes going on. Obviously, Cabin in the Woods, like who would ever go to the Cabin in the Woods with all of their friends? None of us should be doing this. We should know by now. There's plenty to enjoy. Do you think they'll do a sequel? Having said that the ending is an interesting ending, but do you think that there's room for that?
So I don't think you'd have to do that much to justifiably get this group of people back together again. They do feel like in each other's lives. And, you know, I mean, it's horror. We've had dumb reasons for sequels in the past. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even if it's probably not logical that they might go to another cabin in the woods, like, I feel like you could come up with a reason to get them there. But, you know, I was just always thinking throughout it about Eddie Murphy's Delirious, which is, you know, a very problematic stand-up special in many ways, but in other areas stands up. And he talks about how you can't have black people in horror films and make them act the same as white people would do. And this film, I think, just like gets that in a really, really fun way, even though they do a lot of the kind of typical things of like splitting up when they should stay together.
But they do it very self-awarely, don't they? They're fully, you know, when Allison, one of the characters, actually suggests it, she's dry heaving into her mouth because she knows it's the worst thing you could possibly suggest, not only in a horror movie, but especially as black characters, that this is just a terrible idea. So it really is knowing. And, you know, at the beginning, you mentioned this sort of bit, this setup, pre-title setup where they talk about, you know, the two big actors will probably get killed off because they couldn't afford them or whatever, and then the two actors sort of do break that fourth wall slightly by looking at each other. So there's that sort of absolute self-awareness of the world in which this film comes out and the history and the legacy in which it sits that is just really, really clever for somebody that either likes horror movies or enjoys film in general. There's so much history wrapped up in that, as well as social commentary, that is just an intriguing mix.
Just such a pleasant surprise, this one. Yeah, I really didn't come into it with like terribly high expectations, and, you know, just absolutely delighted. And, you know, at a time where kind of writers and actors are like having a bit of a rough time, it's very nice to see something that's like the writing is actually what made this great. And like the fact that you have all these like quirky performers that are making very specific choices is what makes it great.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
not to take it away from Tim Story, who did also a good job.
Yes, indeed. So I think we can say we would recommend you get down to the cinema and see this. Maybe buy some Kool-Aid to have before you go in. Pack of cards you might need for when you get back out.
Yeah, it will make you want to learn how to play spades. Which, as somebody who loves to play spades, is, you know, welcome to my people.
Yes, I don't know how to play that, so you'll have to teach me. So that is The Blackening, and that is out in cinemas on a big screen on Friday. Okay, so from screaming to singing then, it's this.
We only have 3 weeks to create a masterpiece. It's on you now. All on you.
Let's do this.
And cue cocaine.
You need to know that only 3% of people make it. The rest end up in a mental facility or on a go-go box in Hell's Kitchen.
This is a complete disaster.
Everything is gonna be okay.
It doesn't work away.
We're theater people. We know how to turn cardboard into gold.
Okay, so this is theater camp. This is all of the jazz hands, Layla. What's going on with this theater camp that's under threat?
Yeah, so it's this kind of theater camp where kids go to the summers in order to kind of do theater and musical theater. It's kind of seems to be a very American phenomenon. So kind of these young preteens, but the owner has kind of fallen into ill health, and she's got this kind of slightly obnoxious kind of tech bro son who is now having to be in charge and run the theater camp and all these rather eccentric musical theater kids and kind of former musical theater kid teachers. And it's on the brink of collapse. And there's a much fancier theatre camp nearby, which is run by the wonderful Patty Harrison. So yes, it's kind of a classic underdog story of like these scrappy young kids have to put on a great show. But it's very much mocking that world of theatre kids and like musical theatre people.
Yes, and it stars Ben Platt, who is, you know, the ultimate theatre kid, who played Evan Hansen, and it has been a Broadway star and has, I imagine, grown up in these kind of worlds. And this is co-written by Platt along with Molly Gordon, Nick Lieberman, and Platt's fiancé, Noah Galvin, who also appears in the film. It's coming from a place of experience, but did it sell that experience to you, Layla? Is it funny? Did you relate to it? Could you empathize with these characters?
It is funny. Like, a lot of the jokes are really funny. You know, it's very witty. There's kind of a lot of small things and, you know, kind of poking fun at like how incredibly seriously these people take themselves. I did wonder, it kind of a bit overstayed its welcome with me. Like, I kind of like got it after a while. And even though it was like 90 minutes and like a perfectly sweet little romp, I didn't really care that much about like act three. And yeah, there is a bit of poking fun at people that gets a little bit repetitive. Like, I get it, they do take themselves very seriously. But the writing's solid, the performances are solid. It just kind of, you know, I ended up glazing over a little bit, which I think can happen when it's essentially one joke in a million creative ways, but it's still one joke.
Yeah, I agree. I actually found this a little bit tiresome. That might be because I can't think of anything worse as a child than being stuck in a camp like this. It would have been my absolute nadir to be made to do musicals and sing songs and sort of run around with people who are incredibly jazz handsy. But I think it's really affectionate as well towards those people. So if that is your jam, I think you'll recognise a lot of the sort of dramatic twists and turns and the people that populate this camp. And you know, the songs are pretty good and catchy. I just found it grating. And actually, towards the end, I actually actively disliked it because of that. I don't know that I'm the best audience for it. I think there will be an audience. I know that it was incredibly well received at Sundance. People loved it. We saw it at Sundance, didn't we? And it was one of those ones that people were like, oh, have you seen Theatre Camp? That's delightful. So maybe I'm just being a snowbound Grinch Sundance styly because of my dislike of it. But I just did find it one note. In as much as aren't theatre kids funny because they're so into themselves and so very serious about art. And that seemed to be the whole thing of it. And there was no other further nuance. So yeah, it irritated me and I wouldn't suggest you go and see it unless you are somebody who grew up doing, you know, sort of waiting for Godot revivals in the middle of the woods or whatever else they do.
I have to say, I did find myself, I have this like long going theory about like theatre and young people and how that works internationally in terms of like gender roles. And like a lot of the third act of this, I was like, I'm developing this theory because I feel like in America, which I'm no expert, but it does seem to be very plucky outsider.
Yes.
Like the theatre kid. And so kind of a lot of our, you know, the American stars kind of have that spirit about them. And this is my theory as to why so many of the giant action stars are from England and Australia, where I think a lot of the kind of lead in the school play person who could sing and dance and stuff is actually also the giant most popular guy at school. It's like your kind of Richard Maddens and your Hugh Jackmans and your Mel Gibsons and Russell Crowe's. Like, I don't think, like, if you're not from America, like being a theater kid is quite the same thing. So maybe that's like what we're not connecting to.
Yes, like theatre kids in my school were sort of a bit mean girls and not the idiots and geeks, which is how they're generally portrayed here. You know, it's like the kid from American Pie who always is at band camp and the things she can do with her flute, and like she's a total nerd and why would you ever hang out with her? They're not necessarily the same kids that we know from our experience. So yeah, maybe that is the disconnect for me. Maybe I just don't recognise them. But yeah, it wasn't for me. I wouldn't necessarily say part with your money on this one, would you?
I think if you are someone who is an American who's had like experience with these theater kids, like there might be a lot of kind of things that you like take in being recognized. But as an outsider who doesn't really like connect with this community, because again, the theater people in my school were the most popular girls and boys in school. This, I couldn't fully get there with this, but would say Patty Harrison, always an absolute treat. And Ayo Edebiri, who's in The Bear.
She's
just a joy. The one that I found almost most amusing as a character was this kind of very jaded choreographer who's talking about like all the pitfalls of Hollywood and none of you will make it and it's miserable out there and it's basically the Hunger Games, and it's like, okay, that crosses the Atlantic.
Yeah, you know, and I say this as somebody who watched Fame, so I liked that, but yeah, this just didn't work for me. Okay, so that is Theatre Camp, and that is out in cinemas on Friday. So from theatre kids then to Latchdoor Key kids, it's this.
Who's Josie?
Who's asking?
I'm Jason. I'm your dad.
Can't stay for long.
I'll stay as long as I want.
What if he's a big-time gangster?
Maybe he was in prison.
So hear me out on this one, yeah?
No, he's not a vampire. That's just stupid.
You think you'll stay?
I don't care. I think you can just turn out, say sorry, and it'll all be all right.
Your mum never wanted me around, you know?
She said that, did she?
I knew it.
But you didn't even try.
Okay, so this is Scrapper, the debut of filmmaker Charlotte Regan. Layla, Scrapper. Who's a Scrapper in this? What's going on?
Oh, so we have this delightful little girl called Georgie, who's 12 years old, and she's like living on this estate. She's played by newcomer Lola Campbell, who is just the most delightful little talent. So she's living independently. She basically has come up with all methods of ingenious ways to keep social services off her back and also sustain herself. A lot of that comes from just like nicking things, but you know, you can't help but like admire the kind of ingenuity with which she is like managing to live her life. Her mother kind of has passed away a little bit beforehand, but she has managed to kind of live independently. But the inciting incident of this is that her father, Jason, who's played by Harris Dickinson, returns, kind of wanting to reconnect, wanting to kind of have a bit of a relationship with her. And it's a sort of like coming of age tale, but also like a bonding of the two. It's like whimsical and cute, and they've got such a lovely chemistry. I just thought it was delightful.
Yeah, it sort of reminded me of After Sun, but not much lighter than that in terms of the comedy, and not a sort of having this foreboding that hangs over After Sun. But that idea of this sparky girl, Lola, is just incredibly good, and reminds me of Frankie from After Sun. And that amazing relationship that is built in front of your eyes on screen with Dickinson is just incredible. I adored this film. And they're both sort of Scrapper in that respect, aren't they? Because, you know, she is trying to fend for herself and living alone and living on her wits and pretending she needs no one and pretending that she doesn't feel the grief that she actually is, that she allows herself to feel in the dark after everyone's gone to bed, and she, you know, sneaks off and very quietly looks at pictures of her mum. She's sort of really trying to be stoic. And Jason equally is a bit of a lost soul. He's living in Ibiza. He's having a great time. He's living with the lads. You know, he's going out clubbing. He's doing all this stuff. But actually, there's something missing in his heart too. And he's looking for something and a connection as well. So they're both sort of scrappy little underdogs that find somewhere in between that they can meet. And I love the sort of very British nature of that as well, that it's not slushy and mushy, that even, you know, if they were to express any sort of friendship, I mean, God forbid, love to each other, then it has to be in a sort of snarky, teasing and awkward fashion. And it felt so authentic and so lovely. And I think anybody could watch it and understand that feeling that each of them have, that sort of feeling lost in a certain period of your time and hoping that the other person could perhaps let down their defences to form a relationship. I loved it.
No, I really agree. I think it's one that actually only gets better kind of the more you think about it. And like, particularly when it comes to like British films where we tend to have like working class stories be like unrelentingly grim.
Yeah.
Like this felt like someone, and you know, Charlotte Regan is from a kind of similar background, not that she was kind of nicking bikes to get by, she grew up on an estate, and I think she's got this ability to be like, well, there's plenty of like beauty and magic in the world when you're 12 and like living in this place. It isn't just like an unrelentingly bleak space, and like it's really important to kind of depict the sort of magic of childhood even in what might outwardly seem like a really dire circumstance. And you know, I've seen a couple of films recently, I mean, there's one in particular that was set in a factory, and I could just see from minute one, oh, this person's never worked in a factory. Yeah. You know, what you're picking up on isn't quite right. And this just felt incredibly, I mean, it's lovely, but it's also authentic. And I really hope we see a lot more from Lola Campbell. I think she's, I hate to put pressure on child stars, but she's really something special.
Yeah, get her and Frankie from After Sun in a film together. That's what I want to see. I also want to talk about the rest of the community in this. You know, you mentioned that it's not unrelentingly bleak, and you know, there is the possibility of a sort of mean girls element here, or other people that surround Lola that may not be kind to her. But in fact, really, generally, everybody is really kind and looking out for her. Even, you know, the mother of a girl who Lola lashes out against, there is a sort of understanding there. And although she's furious, there's an understanding of what this girl is going through. And then even the spiders in her house talk, and there's a sort of quite weird section where the spiders all have a chat to each other that she doesn't want to hoover up in a hoover while she's cleaning up the house and keeping it spick and span in the way mum would want it. These little flights of fantasy are part of that, and the idea as well that the two of them go off with a metal detector searching for treasure, and that's essentially what this whole film is basically about. It's two people casting around over Earth as they go throughout this film, looking for that beeper to go off and that connection to be made. And when it happens, it makes your heart sore.
It really does. I'm always a little bit resistant to kind of like sentimentality. Maybe like the first time I watched this, I was kind of, you know, had my defenses up. But I did just rewatch yesterday, and I was really struck by like actually how delicately those moments are done, and they're really not overwrought and saccharine and stuff. And yes, thought it was deeply moving.
I think it will probably do well come awards season. I think it's something that people will watch and remember, and it will stay with them. And when we come to awards bodies making nominations at the end of this year, I suspect that Scrapper might be in debut contention.
I mean, it did. I think it won something decent at Sundance. I can't quite remember what, but, you know, one of the big ones. And yeah, I think the kind of stuff that is outwardly nice, I think, often gets kind of underserved by awards bodies. Like they go in a bit more for like brutal suffering. Perhaps that they'll kind of see something in this one, because it really is a very, very exciting debut.
Yes.
In a year of very exciting debuts, particularly from British filmmakers.
Yes, and British female filmmakers. Another person who has created something that has a very particular voice and feels entirely their own work. So, yeah, I can't wait to see what this director does next. We will see. So if you fancy a bit of Scrapper, Scrapper is out in cinemas on Friday. It's delightful. Okay, so finally, shall we go back to a galaxy far, far away? It's time to go back there again with this.
I've spent most of my life fighting a war. That's why I'm trying to convince you to help me prevent another one.
You and I both know who could help you with this.
She
She's still just as stubborn as ever.
I bet your master found you difficult at times.
Anakin never got to finish my training. I walked away from him, just like I walked away from Sabine. You never made things easy for me. Master.
As a Jedi, sometimes you have to make the decision no one else can. But I'm counting on you to see this through.
Nice haircut.
Okay, so this is Ahsoka. It's set in about the same time as Mandalorian, but follows a very different set of people. Layla, who are we picking up in this galaxy this time around?
So it's Ahsoka Tano, who's played by Rosario Dawson in what I would say is genuinely a perfect bit of casting. She's kind of best known as a character from more of the animated series, and she sort of was a smaller character, but then became very, very beloved. From what I understand, she was the kind of apprentice of Anakin, and that was kind of a bit of a throwaway point. But as the years went on, she becomes more significant, and arguably her kind of already established path is like almost as gargantuan as like the Skywalker arc in terms of like her significance to this like larger galaxy. So that's a very difficult thing, I think, for this show to do, where you're kind of having to come and please people, have years and years of history with this character and a million references to her, but they're also trying to like be able to introduce her to someone who is just coming into this like for a new Disney Plus show and has maybe seen the movies.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see the seams of that quite a lot. There's some potential. It's having seen a little bit of the animated series, but not all of it, it did feel a little bit kind of slower and more conservative than that. I think Rosario Dawson is a skilled kind of stunt fighter, but she can't quite match like the fun flair of like how Ahsoka fights with two lightsabers in the animated series, because it's just so kind of wild and physically impossible to do. And we get a lot of kind of exposition in the first episodes and a lot of kind of MacGuffin.
Yeah, it's all about getting to Thrawn.
I'm going to watch episode 3. I think there's something here.
They've dropped 2, and then it will be weekly, so you'll have to wait once you've gobbled up the first 2 episodes. I know what you're saying about that idea of the animated show, because obviously being animated, they move in a different fashion than a physical woman will. But I still think there's a great deal of fun and sort of a cultural moment in her with her lightsaber, and also, you know, lightsaber fights against another woman. We haven't seen that in the Star Wars universe in the live action so far. So that's kind of a thrill. I think it looks fantastic. It looks great. That sort of Disney Plus money is certainly on screen. And I just think that Rosario is such a nerdy fan of this herself. She was so interested in playing the role when it was a fan idea before it ever became a reality, that I just think that it feels like she is made to play the part, and that runs right through her. So when she's in the quieter moments and she's actually emoting and having to sell this character, who is, you know, orange skinned with these big accoutrements on the head, you totally believe it, and you're totally buy the entire thing from her. So I think that's really important. And also she has presence as well. You know, when she comes on screen, you're like, she's so cool. Before she even opens her mouth, you're like, I believe that she is really cool. So yeah, I think this is a really nice element that's come into this larger world. And I'm really interested to see where they will take that in the following episodes, and where we'll come out at, and what that opens up in this universe, and what characters and what alliances. I couldn't really give a stuff about Thrawn. I'm not that into that. But I do enjoy the dynamics between the women.
Yeah, this central trio of like Rosario Dawson, Natasha Louis Bordizzo, and Mary Elizabeth Winstead is like quite a compelling one. And they're all like very strong actresses. But, you know, I don't get too much into the physicality, but like I found some of Mary Elizabeth Winstead's prosthetics somehow less compelling. Well, it's like Rosario Dawson, like that big kind of fleshy hair really does like feel part of her, whilst I don't know, the Mary Elizabeth Winstead kind of green tentacly hair felt a bit Jim Henson Workshops, but like in a bad way.
Oh, Oh dear. She can go home and ask her other half how to do this stuff, because she's obviously with Ewan McGregor in real life. So I would hope that she knows her Star Wars. But no, I didn't think that. I quite like the old tentacles, but I can see what you're saying. Rosario, you know, she wears the outfit. The outfit doesn't wear her. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that's part of her just being so fully into it and so fully believing herself as this character, and has been for many years, that maybe that's what's working for her favour.
Yeah, I think it'd just be interesting to see how well this does, because, you know, I think people were really not happy with the last season of The Mandalorian, and, you know, whether there might not be kind of the attention to this that it would be given. But I would say so far it's as promising a debut as that or Boba Fett was when they first started out. It's just whether or not they can kind of sustain it.
Yes, it's the sustaining that is the issue, isn't it? I mean, I think, you know, Ahsoka did appear in the Book of Boba Fett very briefly. So there's that link as well. It remains to be seen whether this has the ability to take us on that ride and fully engage us all the way through. But I think based on the first two, I don't think people who are Star Wars fans will be disappointed. I think it's got everything that you would want from that world.
And yeah, it's nice again that it's like centralized around this like really strong actor, because I had this real conspiracy theory for a long time that Pedro Pascal was only in that suit for the times where he was taking off his mask for like once or twice a season. And he did do some interviews that kind of suggested that I might not be too far off, but this is like pure Rosario. And
yes,
it knows that Rosario is its greatest strength, and it's not just about lore. So far, at least, it really seems to kind of appreciate her skills as an actor, even if you can't quite fight like a cartoon can.
Oh, goodness me, you are still, you've got to let it go, Layla. You've got to let it go. Rosario is, you know, she's doing her very best there, and she cannot physically do the things that a cartoon character can.
You're right, I'm being unreasonable.
Okay, so if you fancy checking out Rosario Dawson and her lightsaber action, which I would say is excellent, Layla's just being stingy and mean, it is on Disney Plus now, and there's the first two episodes and the rest will be dropping weekly. Okay, so that is it for this week, Layla. If you had to choose one to go and see or to stay in to see, which one would it be?
I would say if you're going out, it's going to be The Blackening. It's such a kind of like, you know, maybe get a giant tango ice blast that you maybe slipped a bit of vodka into, and kind of a badly behaved cinema, but kind of in the best way. People being quite loud and raucous and just like having a whale of a time. Like I've seen this film twice. I think I've got to go down to Peck and Plex and see it another time, just because I think it's going to be such a fun time at the movies in a way that like Barbie was when we all went dressed in pink and like, you know, just like really, really up for it. I think this is a proper go and see it with a community sort of vibe.
Yes. If you enjoyed that blockbuster aspect of Barbie and Oppenheimer, this could be the next thing that's, you know, let's go and do this big with your biggest Slurpee cup. And I know I'm contradicting myself entirely, because I hate that stuff when I go to the cinema usually, but this feels very much like it encourages a Rocky Horror vibe. Shout at the screen, rustle your popcorn, slurp your drink. However, I'm going to pick Scrapper, because I think there's a quiet beauty and a loveliness to that one that will take people by surprise and stay with them long after they've left the cinema. So that would be my choice. Okay, so just a reminder then that the new issue is on sale now, and it has The Marvels on the cover, and it features the lovely Layla in her column, The L Word. And what are you talking about in this issue, Layla?
So this issue, we're talking about nostalgia and like the whole way that like Hollywood tries to sell our childhood back to ourselves. But some recent box offices suggest that maybe that's not the greatest marketing tool.
I think Indiana Jones.
Yeah, Indiana Jones. But also quite a few of them. I mean, I think I've kind of had this idea bubbling in my mind ever since that absolutely bizarre Buzz Lightyear, based on the man that the Buzz Lightyear toy was like, you know,
it's based on.
Yeah, that was the level where I was like, this is a broken system where we cannot just have nostalgia for nostalgia for nostalgia and expect people to be like really excited to go. You got to do a Barbie. You've got to like reinvent something. You can take something from a childhood, but you can't just be like, here it is, and expect people to show up.
Okay. fighting talk then. So that is on sale now. A reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing to it. If you press a button now, you're all set for future episodes. Before we go, though, we have time for a listener's question. What's your favourite jump scare? Well, this ties into The Blackening. There's some good ones in that. But what's your all-timer favourite?
I've kind of got two. One of them is the moment where the head arrives in Jaws, which was something they kind of added quite late in, where you kind of think they tested it with audiences and they just felt that they could do one more big scare.
They filmed it in his swimming pool, didn't they, and poured milk in the water so that it wasn't too clear, so it looked like the sea, and did it in the swimming pool.
Yeah, and apparently it's just some sort of local eccentric whose head they cast. But I mean, I've seen that film far too many times, but now when I watch it, the scare always works. But then I also have a moment of felt like, oh, okay, so the shark just bit off this person's body and then like neatly put him back inside the heart.
Just nudged it back in with his nose. That would be a nice scare for when they come looking for my tooth.
But the other one is like, I mean, I love horror films, but often like the jump scare is like at the expense of like actually making something genuinely terrifying. And for me, I love The Descent so much for that, where I'm claustrophobic. This was already a full nightmare to me before any sort of creatures appeared. But like the idea that they generally crafted something slow burn terrifying. And then when the jump scares come, when the creatures appears, I think, yeah, my kind of soul left my body. And my then boyfriend, who was not a horror fan, that may have been the reason for the demise of that relationship. He was so unhappy.
Yes. I'm going to say one that's not a traditional horror scare in as much as it's not a beastie or whatever, but it really made me jump, and it wasn't what I was expecting the film to go, is the moment in Hereditary when Alex Wolff is driving along in the car with his little sister in the back, and a decapitation happens, and it's just, what just happened? And then now I can't trust anything, and now I've no idea where this film is going. And of course, that film did go in places that I was just like, what the hell? People crawling on ceilings and on fire, et cetera, et cetera. And then the horror of the aftermath of that the day after with the ants. That entire thing is a creepy, creepy thing that no matter how many times I watch it and know it's coming, it still makes me actually physically sort of jump. It's so violent and so unnecessary. Not in a filmmaking sense, but in this real sort of scenario that we're asked to sort of step into. It's such an unnecessary accident to happen, or is it an accident? And I thought that was so genius. And it was when we sort of were like, oh, Ari Aster, hello. Yeah. This is very interesting. And he's continued to make films, not necessarily that I like, but that always challenge me and always wrong foot me and second guess me. And I'm always very interested to see them. So that would be mine. Cool. All right. Yeah. Well, that is that for this week. We've got to do some packing, Layla.
We do.
I think we have to pack a brolly for next week in Venice. The weather's not very good, but hopefully the sunshine will last. Next week, we'll be back with Jamie and Emily, who will be discussing that week's releases. But for now, we shall say goodbye. Say goodbye, Layla.
Goodbye. And everyone, please pray to the weather gods that like these forecasts prove very inaccurate and we get glorious sunshine. But yes, goodbye.
Goodbye. And it's goodbye from me. I don't know what to say. I never know how to say myself. Bye, bye, bye.
Arrivederci.
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 To do the mambo like crazy, and hey mambo, don't wanna tarantella, hey mambo, no more the mozzarella, hey mambo, Italiano, try an enchilada with a fish of bacalhau, and hey gumba, I love how you dance, rumba.